We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning in this hour of the program, we'll be talking about daily life in a place that many people regard as the deadliest city in the world. The place we're talking about is the Mexican city of Ciudad Juarez. It's on the U.S.-Mexico border, right across from El Paso, Texas. And our guest for the program is Charles Bowden. We'll be talking about what you will find in his new book titled Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. It's published by Nation Books and has just recently come out. Let me just read to you a little bit from the book that will give you a feeling for what it is we're talking about. In the book, he makes this argument that there are two Mexicos. There is one that's reported by the U.S. press, a place where the Mexican president is fighting a valiant war against the evil forces of the drug world and using the incorruptible Mexican army as his warriors. This Mexico has newspapers, courts, and laws, and is seen by the U.S. government as a sister republic. He goes on to write, it does not exist. There is a second Mexico where the war is for drugs, for the enormous money to be made in drugs, where the police and the military fight for their share, where the press is restrained by the murder of reporters and feasts on a steady diet of bribes, and where the line between government and the drug world has never existed. Our guest is the recipient of a Lannan Literary Award for nonfiction and also the Sidney Hillman Award. He's the author of a number of books, including Down by the River, A Shadow in the City, and Some of the Dead Are Still Breathing. He's contributing editor for GQ and Mother Jones, also writes for Harper's, New York Times Book Review, and Aperture. He makes his home in Tucson. He's joining us this morning by phone. As we talk, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and you may also send along your comments and questions by email, and the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Mr. Bowden, hello.
Well, howdy. Thanks for having me.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Oh, I've got 24 hours every day. So I just share it with everyone.
I know that you have been following life in Mexico and in the border region for a while, and that the book particularly is a product of a year of concentrated time on Ciudad Juarez, the year 2008. What is it about this place that draws you and makes you feel that there's a story here that needs to be told?
Okay. I think it's a laboratory where we can see the future. I drifted into Juarez in June of 1995 on a magazine assignment pursuing a murder that had happened in the neighboring city of El Paso, Texas. And I was struck by what I saw at that time. I saw a city with the lowest unemployment in Mexico, with hundreds of American-owned factories, and with mass poverty. People were living in cardboard boxes and shacks made out of loading dock pallets. It was dominated by the Juarez cartel, which at that time, DEA's intelligence told me, was earning $250 million a week. The head of the cartel was never mentioned out loud in a bar. His name was never in the newspaper. It was never mentioned on radio or television. And there were a lot of murders then, I thought. You know, people just disappeared. Nothing was said. And I was, I'm the ignorant, as always, American boy. And I was flabbergasted and started writing about it. Now I realize what I just described to you, what I saw then, was like Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. At that time, there were about 250 homicides a year in Juarez officially. Last year, there were 2,600 murders in Juarez. It's, without question, statistically the most violent city in the world now. Caracas lost the crown. They used to have 132 murders per 100,000. Juarez last year ran about 200 officially. This year, the killing's even worse. So that's how I squandered 15 years in a nutshell.
So certainly it was not a wonderful place to be. There was a lot of violence, say, going back to the mid-90s, but it seems that, say, within about the last 4 years, there has been a very significant increase in the level of violence. So then one would have to ask the question, well, what's happened there recently to make it so much worse?
Okay, I can answer that. But I'll give a few statistics first. In 2007 was the most violent year in the history of the city, 307 murders, I think. 2008, when I became Thunderstruck, had 1,600 murders and so forth. I realized that everything I knew about this city had changed, that this was something new to have that explosion of violence. What happened was a new president of Mexico was elected or assumed office in December 2006, Felipe Calderon, and he initiated a sort of combat against the drug industry, sending essentially 50,000 soldiers to try and seize control of the country in his eyes. I think what he inadvertently did was rip the mask off the problems of Mexico. The problem of Mexico is it doesn't have a rule of law and mass poverty. On the point of it doesn't have a rule of law, I'll toss out one statistic that your listeners will understand. 93% of the people convicted in Mexico never see a judge or an arrest warrant. They're just processed. That the law is a joke there, the way we talk about it. Well, what he did then was, going back to Juarez has raised several generations now of feral kids, and by that I mean their parents both work in these factories. They get very little education after the sixth grade. They're on the streets. There's 500 to 900 street gangs now, heavily armed, et cetera. And so the city reached a kind of crisis point. And now you can't put the genie back in the bottle. There's 5 to 15 murders a day. The police are getting slaughtered, mainly by each other. There's 11,000 federal agents and soldiers now in Juarez, and since they arrived, the killings have increased dramatically. And one last little fact that I think your listeners will understand. Last year, there were over 2,600 murders, and there were maybe 30 arrests for murder. Not convictions, just arrests. Most of those people were released. So in other words, you can kill anyone you want in Juarez and nothing will happen to you.
So we got hundreds of street gangs, the army is there, the federal police there, and having all this this armed force hasn't made things better. It actually made things worse. It sounds as if what you have there is just a free-for-all.
Well, except there's a charge, you get dead. Yes, I understand. What you have to understand is the Mexican economy. The leading source officially of foreign currency in Mexico is the export of oil. Their oil fields are collapsing. At this moment, oil revenues provide, it's a nationalized industry, I should say, oil revenues provide the Mexican government with 40% of the federal budget. The president of Mexico has announced these fields will be exhausted in less than 10 years. The second official source of foreign currency is foreign remittances, meaning illegal Mexicans are in the United States illegally, working like dogs, sending money home to keep their families alive. That's $20 to $25 billion. The drug industry, according to DEA, earns $30 to $50 billion. So when you see a sinking economy, the drug industry isn't the darkness at the edge of town. It's a massive source of revenue. And so people fight over who gets a piece of that. The state police fight the federal police. Both of them kill the city police. The army's in there fighting for their share. This is all logical, and it isn't going to go away.
This violence has gotten some attention in the U.S. press recently because a couple of weeks ago, some people who were connected with the consulate, the U.S. consulate in Ciudad Juarez, were murdered. So that made the papers here in the media in the United States. Otherwise, it seems that this is something that doesn't get very much attention in the U.S. media. Why is that?
Because we don't care about Mexicans, or I can put it more bluntly. There were three people affiliated with the consulate were executed in broad daylight on March 13th. Suddenly, Secretary Hillary Clinton and other worthies fly down to Mexico to announce our support for their war against drugs, etc. 5,000 human beings have been slaughtered in Juarez in over 3 years. The murder rate's going up. They don't matter. That's the thing. The other thing is, while I'm on this point, there is a theme in the U.S. press, especially about politicians, about violence spilling across the border. Mm-hmm. It's functionally a bunch of nonsense. El Paso has 800,000 people. It physically abuts. Whereas if you stand in one, it looks like one city looking at the other. Mm-hmm. So far, there's been over 600 people slaughtered in Juarez this year. Mm-hmm. There's been one murder in El Paso. And it's that way all across the border. There are incidents, but it's minor. U.S. agencies and U.S. politicians use this theme about homeland security and security on the border simply to expand their agency budgets. It hasn't really happened, and I don't think it's likely to happen. What's happening is a slaughter in Mexico as people fight to survive, and as heavily armed criminal groups feeding off that $30 to $50 billion fight for turf and whatever else. The final thing you should know is most of the people getting killed are just ordinary citizens in Juarez. The Mexican government says 90% of the people who have died in these last 3 years or 2.5 years are dirty. But they give absolutely no evidence. If you do what I did in 2008 and start examining the dead, they're really poor people. And I guess the way they're dirty is they're in a barrio where there's no money, where there's no hope. And they're standing on a street corner, and if you go up to them, you can buy a little packet of cocaine or something. You know, these are not kingpins, drug lords, or any of that nonsense. What they're doing is what we saw in our touted television show, The Wire, on HBO, mm-hmm. about Baltimore, where you see poor people doing... involved in an industry that's the only one left. In that case, it was selling drugs on street corners in Baltimore. Same thing's happening in Juarez. There's an estimated 150 to 200,000 addicts down in the city.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Charles Bowden, and he's the author of a newly published book, which is about life in the Mexican town of Ciudad Juarez. It's right on the U.S.-Mexico border, right across from El Paso. The title of his book is Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. It's published by Nation Books. Charles Bowden makes his home in Tucson, Arizona. He's the author of a number of books and won a number of awards for his work. And he's talking with us this morning by phone. And questions are welcome. If you're listening in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. If it would be a toll-free or long-distance call, I should say, we do have a toll-free line, so we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. And you can email to will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have a caller here to start us off on our toll-free line up in Yorkville, and that's line number 4 right here. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, that's pretty disturbing there, what you're talking about. I used to live in California, and in fact, most of my family still does. I'm the only outsider, but the old days, you used to be able to go between, San Diego and Tijuana, no problem. We used to take dirt bikes and do the Baja 1000 thing and go across in Ensenada all the time and never had problems. Now, I guess it's gotten way out of control. You got where my family lives in the high desert, there's just nothing but rock houses and drug dealers, and the cops are basically, the law enforcement people are just overwhelmed. And the biggest problem in this country that we have is that we're given, they get prosecuted like everybody else, but we're also giving them the benefits of illegal, being here legally instead of illegally, instead of sending them back across the border because of all the legalese. And I guess my question is, we're not getting cooperation from south of the border, and we're not getting cooperation here from our own people, because for some reason, they think if you take somebody that's a drug runner or illegal, that's considered racism. And this is a fact, especially in the border states, where it seems like there's a difficulty trying to do something with these people. I don't know. How do you feel? And I was curious, am I correct, or am I just talking off the top of my head? I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Okay, You're correct in some things, and some, well, you may be correct in all things, but some things I don't agree with. If you go down to any U.S. port of entry on the Mexican border, you'll see busloads of Mexicans all day long being kicked back. In the Tucson sector, they kick back 400,000 to 500,000 a year. So it's not like they get a free ride. What you have is an economic problem in Mexico and a social problem in the United States that we're trying to address through criminal means. The economic problem in Mexico is the flight of the Mexican poor from a failed society. There's at least 10 million people living and working here illegally now. The social problem we're trying to address through criminal means is drug consumption by U.S. citizens. The war on drugs is now 40 years old, and I'll tell you exactly what it's accomplished. It's accomplished the largest prison population on earth per capita, and every drug in this country is now of higher quality, more available, and cheaper than it was 40 years ago. It's also created a massive police state of narcotics officers that cost us tens of billions. So we have two policies. One is free trade NAFTA, which I didn't mention, but I think your listeners are aware of it. The other is our war on drugs, and they've blown up in our faces. And the all we can come up with is we should put more money into them. It seems to me we should examine the consequences of our own acts and think about this a little more. Now, there was a rancher killed in southern Arizona last week. Nobody knows who killed him, but quite possibly it was an illegal Mexican. He was out on his ATV, and they found his body. He'd been shot, et cetera. He'd sent a phone message that would indicate he was being attacked by Mexicans. If it were Mexicans, he most likely had the unfortunate experience of running in to some guys moving drugs on foot. They're usually armed to protect the load, and this happened. But I have to say that, so there is violence. But I spend my summers on the border and have for 3 years. I live in an area, I spend those summers in an area where there's constant streams of these guys going through with guns and drug loads. They stack at sometimes 500 yards from the house I've been in, and there's no problem because the industry runs by trying to avoid notice. So that what we have, as I said, are a social problem and an economic problem, and sending troops there isn't going to solve it. It's a 2,000-mile-long border. But we also have another problem. There's 38 states in this country with growing illegal Mexican populations. There's over 10 million people, I think. Estimates vary. It's a little hard to get an accurate tally. I don't think we're going to line up a trainload of cattle cars and send them back. That we have to learn to live with them, and we have to face the fact that we either have a shadow population with limited rights, earning miserable wages, or we incorporate them into our nation and give them citizenship. And I know that's a forbidden subject almost politically. But the last time we tried to have a shadow population that worked here and didn't have full human rights and legal rights, we had a civil war, and it killed 600,000 of us. So that I think we have to smell the coffee.
I want to ask you to talk some more about what this has to do with the global economy. The subtitle of the book is Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields.
Sure,
in what sense is this somehow bound up with globalism?
Okay, NAFTA. NAFTA is the North American Free Trade Agreement between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. It passed and it started being implemented in early 1994. Within 18 months of its implementation, illegal migration skyrocketed into the United States, and I'll tell you exactly why. NAFTA destroyed peasant agriculture in Mexico because it couldn't compete with agribusiness here. It also destroyed small industry, which had been sheltered by a tariff wall because it couldn't compete with American and Asian products. This unleashed a turbulence in the society, an absolute decline in the standard of living, and a lot of people decided to come north. It also produced, because of the massive shipment of goods back and forth, a wonderful way to transmit drugs more easily. And the final thing is, these American factories that are in Mexico under NAFTA, under the Free Trade Agreement, have several characteristics. One are wages that none of your listeners could possibly live on. You start at $40 a week, you might make it up to $60 a week. the turnover in these plants is 100 to 200% in a country with 50% of the people living in poverty. These things are slave factories, basically. And they've cost American jobs because basically the rule of thumb is you take what you pay an American worker, say, in Illinois per hour, and that's what you pay a Mexican worker per day. Now, the other characteristic of these factories is we send all the parts there and Mexicans assemble them, and then they all get shipped back here. What that means is their only input is wages. This isn't growing their economy in any meaningful sense, and since the wages are very low, it doesn't create any social peace. It creates ruin. Hmm. That's what I mean by the killing fields. What you have in war is, I'll give you an interesting fact. Mm-hmm. They did a study in Chihuahua. Juarez is the largest city in the state of Chihuahua. Chihuahua is the largest state in Mexico. It's the one abutting a lot of Texas. They found out that 40% of the young men's aspiration was to become sicarios, which is contract killers, because that was the only way out they could see. Even though they know if you go into the life, the crazy life, you're going to be dead probably by the time you're 20. It was at least a reasonable option to them to do that and have at least a fling in life. Now, in Juarez, they're 50% of the young people, meaning teenagers, are neither in school nor do they have a job. There's basically a high school in Juarez for every 500,000 people. And to go to the high school, you have to pay money. They don't have free public education after about the 9th grade. I think anybody listening to these facts realizes this is a recipe for violence and disaster. And it's finally come to a full boil in places like Juarez. The other thing you have to realize, I wrote a book about Juarez, but this violence now is increasingly all over Mexico. It's not just on the border. It's erupting everywhere because the society is finally, I think, hitting a breaking point. The government every day, contrary to what they say, the Mexican government controls less and less of the turf. I just got a long email the other day from an ornithologist from Cornell, who was up in the Sierra Madre. He's been there 5 times in the last 10 months trying to find the imperial woodpecker, which is neither here nor there. But he said he's not going back. The violence has gotten so bad, and this is a scientist and a serious Mexico hand, that he said, everywhere I go, there's people walking around with AKs. Houses are being burned. People are just being killed. He said it's just crazy now. Well, a lot of the country is slowly becoming that way as the state ceases to be able to terrorize and control the people.
That's really seems to be sad in Juarez, and maybe again you're starting to see it other places, is that anybody who can leave, anybody who's got the means to leave, does. And the only people that are left are the people that have no choice.
Well, the way it works is if you have property in Mexico, you can get a visa to visit the U.S., just like many of your listeners have passports. And a lot of those people with money just come here and don't go back. There's an estimated, in the last 2 years, it's estimated 30,000 to 60,000 people from Juarez have moved over to El Paso. Look, there's 116,000 abandoned houses now in Juarez. This is in a city where there's always been a lack of housing. 100,000 jobs have disappeared because of the recession. I mean, I could go on and on. But most of the Mexican people, the poor, can only enter this country illegally. And one thing your listeners should consider, and I hear this all the time, my ancestors came here illegally. Well, when my ancestors came here, the only qualification, you could basically enter the United States unless you were a known criminal or had a terrible disease. There was no criterion until the 1924 Immigration Act. If a Mexican goes down there and says, my God, I want to obey the law, I'm a good person, I want to move to Chicago and get a job in a factory, I'll fill out all the forms, he's going to be 100 years old before his chance in the line comes up. In other words, that's not an option at all. The option is to stay there and die or leave. So they leave. And to their credit, this is something people don't want to talk about, this 20 to 25 billion they're sending back to Mexico. That's more than all the foreign investment. These workers here, that you, when you leave your studio, you'll find one in a back room of a restaurant where you're broadcasting from washing dishes. This is the largest transfer of money to the poor in Mexico in history. It may be the largest social improvement program in history. Poor people are sending billions back every year to other poor people to prop them up. It's an extraordinary thing with no precedent.
We are at our midpoint here of this hour of focus. Charles Bowden is our guest. He's a critically acclaimed author of many books. He's contributing editor for a number of publications, GQ, Mother Jones. Also writes for Harper's Magazine, New York Times Book Review, and Aperture. He makes his home in Tucson. His most recent book is Murder City. The subtitle, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields, is published by Nation Books. It's out now if you want to read it. Questions are welcome here on the show, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk at illinois.edu. We have another caller here, someone in Urbana. We'll talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
It seems to me what you're describing is the utter failure of neoliberalism and, worse yet, neoconservatist economic policies.
Well, I'll go along with you. All those neos seem to have stumbled on this. If you take NAFTA, our free trade agreement, that was initiated by the first President Bush and passed by President Clinton. President Clinton said, with this bill, this will essentially end illegal immigration because everybody in Mexico will be so prosperous they'll stay home and it'll solve all our problems. The treaty has almost no protection environmentally, meaning you wouldn't work in these factories because you wouldn't want to breathe the air. It has no protection for unions, and take my word for it, just try and start a union in Mexico, you're on your way to a cemetery. This thing was passed blindly, I think, in total ignorance, whatever the good intentions, and it should be renegotiated. And by that, I don't want to get people confused, like they think, well, you're against trade. Nobody can stop trade. Treaties merely regulate trade. If you actually could control trade, there wouldn't be any drugs in Champaign-Urbana this morning, but they're there. The biggest industry in Mexico isn't covered by NAFTA or any other trade agreement. It just happens. But what I think we should do is realize this treaty is a failure. It hasn't achieved what it wants. It's dislocated millions of people. It's caused a lot of misery. We should take another look at it. Now, you should want to add, because I've done other stories besides Juarez, it's caused a lot of misery in the United States. You go travel the Rust Belt in Ohio and those places and talk to people who can't go down to their factory job anymore because it's in China or Mexico, it's kind of a wake-up call. You think, well, why is this good for my country to have good jobs leave and have people unemployed that have worked all their life?
It has seemed to me from some time that a chief aim of the agreement was union busting, and it's been very successful.
Well, that's, you know, I've covered a lot of strikes, too. That's been going on in our society deliberately, I think, since, you know, Reagan broke the air traffic controllers in his first term. No, that's true. And, you know, I'm a reporter, not a, I don't run the world, but that's certainly been the pattern. And certainly these factories that move to Mexico move there because they won't deal with unions and they can cut the wages. Now, their defense, what they'll tell you when you talk to these people, is we'd be out of business if we didn't move because some other guy's moving his factory to China and is going to sell things a lot cheaper than I can make them here paying decent wages. What I'm saying, what I want your people to consider is how does it benefit anyone if the object you buy is made by a human being who's getting paid so little they can't even survive on it, and that's true in Juarez. But if you actually endorse those kind of policies, you're creating a world, I think, that's going to blow up in your face. In a place like Juarez, it takes three or four jobs in one of these factories to actually buy what they call the daily basket of needs. Then this is, you know, crazy. I'm sitting here wearing a shirt, which I bought in the United States, which is from Bangladesh. It was probably made by a 10-year-old girl on starvation wages. This is a pattern we've created. Juarez just happens to be an example of the consequences of this behavior. That's right on our border. and it's harder for us to ignore.
Well, thank you for making an effort to describe the situation.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you called.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line number two. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm very interested in your program. I was wondering if the guest can comment on the actual composition of the drug trade that goes through Juarez. Specifically, the reason I ask is I know a lot of activists for legalizing marijuana point to the fact that, well, actually this is the question I have, is whether or not it's a fact, that legalizing the trade of marijuana would cut down on the violence in places like Juarez because we would basically remove most of their drug trade. However, you know, the majority of their drug trade is something like cocaine. Obviously, that's not going to have an effect. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Okay. Look at if here's a current situation. We're imprisoning our people, and we're giving $30 to $50 billion a year in hard currency to killers in Mexico to supply our people with drugs. If we legalize drugs, obviously that market will disappear, meaning drugs are relatively cheap to produce. Some of the consequences of that will be, one, Mexico will economically collapse. The dirty little secret our government won't say publicly, the Mexican government won't admit, is the country is dependent on the drug money. That's to even stay alive. The second thing is, if you suddenly create unemployment in the drug industry in hundreds of U.S. cities and in Mexico, you're not going to have a bunch of guys that are used to making good money decide go get a job down at the Circle K or the Quick Mart. They're going to become violent. And so they're, in the short term, it probably would increase violence. But in the long term, it would reduce it. We know, we have an example. When Prohibition ended, we created vast unemployment for a bunch of bootleggers and gangsters, and we had a lot of crime because they really didn't want a day job. They'd gotten used to good living. So I don't think we have silver bullets here in our choices. We have policy decisions. The policies we have now, I think, are just manifest failures. And so we should actually admit that, have policies based on facts instead of rhetoric, and then have different policies. Personally, after dealing with this for years, I'd legalize all drugs for two reasons. One, I don't think my government has a right to tell anybody what it ingests. And two, the policy of prohibiting them has been a disaster. Then we would transfer this from a criminal problem to a public health problem. In other words, I don't really have a desire to live in a nation of zombies, but I don't think most people would become zombies. To my knowledge, alcohol is legal in this country, and yet I got up this morning, came down here to do this radio show, and didn't have to wade through an army of drunks marauding the place. That we will just have to adapt. Otherwise, we continue the way we're going with a failed policy.
Well, if we stipulate that, I expect probably some number of people who are listening to us would agree with you and would say that would favor legalization. I think it's very unlikely ever to happen, at least no time soon. So if we say that's off the table, are there some other things do you think that the United States government could do that are, at this point, politically doable that would help?
Yeah, certainly. Take the bulk of our drug budget and put it into treatment. I'll give you an example. Arizona's got about 7 million people now. There's 500 beds in the whole state if you want to detox, meaning you come in and you say, I want to get off meth, et cetera. I mean, free beds. I'm not counting the ones where the Rush Limbaughs pay $30,000, you know, to get off their happy pills. Well, this is absurd. Do you think somebody who actually wakes up some morning on the street and wants to cure his addiction can go down there and say, well, here, come back in 97 days when we have a bed available? It's never going to happen. That's one. Look, treat this as a public health problem if you really want to consider it a problem. Don't send the cops. The cops have failed. They know it. I've never met a narc, and I've known a lot of them that pulled, you know, the 20, 30 years. Who didn't think there was something wrong with this, meaning this isn't working. Nor have I met narcs who think it would be great if everybody had cocaine or some other drug. They just know what they're doing isn't working because they've just given their life to it, and everything's worse than the day they started. So that would be an opener. Going back to your initial point, I don't know if we can ever legalize drugs here publicly, but I think you underestimate the enormous talent of the American people for fraud and hypocrisy. I have watched in my lifetime, I was a kid in Chicago when poker was always in the back of the bar in a room, and now it's legal because we don't gamble anymore. We have gaming. I have also watched my entire country become drug addicts through doctors. When I was a kid, it was a big deal to take an aspirin. Now I can't watch television without being told I should go see a physician and get a bottle of Happy Pills because I don't feel well today. I feel blue. But that is not considered drug addiction or even drug use. That's considered medicine. So those are two paths I think we'll pursue, fraud and renaming it.
Our guest in this hour, journalist, writer Charles Bowden. He's the author of a newly published book. The title of his book is Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. And it is set in that city, the Mexican city of Ciudad Juarez, which is on the U.S.-Mexico border. It's right across from El Paso, Texas. His book is published by Nation Books. He's the author of a number. He also contributed to publications like GQ, Mother Jones. He's also written for Harper's, New York Times Book Review. He makes his home in Tucson. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that this the kind of violence we're talking about here hasn't gotten a lot of attention in the U.S. media and only recently has because some Americans were killed. On the other side of the border, maybe you could talk a little bit about what it's like to be a reporter, that is, what it's like to be a Mexican reporter, and to try to really cover this story.
What it's like is to be dangerous. The book is dedicated to Armando Rodriguez, a crime reporter in Juarez who was murdered November 13th, 2008, at 8:30 in the morning as he warmed up his car in front of his home with his 8-year-old daughter sitting on the seat beside him. But Mexico is now probably the most dangerous country in the world to be a reporter. Reporters now survive there by, one, not reporting a lot of things because they'll get killed, or if they report them, not putting their names on the story, no byline. I've watched over the last 3 years the slow strangulation of the Mexican press. Less and less and less is reported. And your listeners should know that the Mexican army, to which we're giving about $500 million a year now under Plan Morita to help them in their noble war against drugs, is just as feared by these reporters as the drug cartels. That this is a free-for-all in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Given that, as you talked before, that you said something like, in Juarez, you can anybody can kill anybody else and nothing will happen, that there is this violence, so much of it, and people can carry out these acts of violence with impunity, you would wonder why anybody would care whether the media reported it or not.
Oh, you mean, look at what they don't want reported is their own doings. No, they're not going to be arrested. But in Murder City, there's a story of a Mexican reporter, Emilio Gutierrez, who the Mexican army tried to kill simply because he reported some of the things they were doing.
Oh, so it's the authorities, the army, the police, they don't want reporters reporting on what they're doing.
No, and the U.S. press is complicit since they report, I think, a fantasy land. I'll give you a statistic where this is supposed to be a war against the Mexican government against the drug cartels. There are 6 or 7 major cartels in Mexico. It's kind of a fluid arrangement, you know. It's not like General Motors, things shift. There have been 53,000 arrests, according to the Mexican government, since they started this war. Only 1.7% of those arrests have been against the cartel they say is the biggest, the Sinaloa cartel. Figure that out. I'll give you another story. The other day, the Mexican army announced that there was a synchronized attack on 2 army bases in Mexico by 7 separate paramilitary gangster groups who hit them all at once in surprise. The U.S. press has reported this without comment. And here's what happened. the Mexican army surprised, ambushed, and synchronized attacks by seven groups. 18 of the attackers die, 7 are arrested, and 1 soldier is slightly injured. If that's actually the way this war works out, the war should be over before we finish this program, because apparently these drug cartels must be using rubber bands or something. What I'm telling your listeners is this account is absolutely preposterous. It's a manufactured story. It's just parroted by the U.S. press. Nobody seems to bother to look into it. And it's nonsense.
Hmm. You know, there's also another prominent character. There's maybe 3 prominent characters in this book. There's a journalist, and there is a sicario. This is
a killer, a hitman.
You talked a little earlier about how there's really almost nothing for young men to aspire to there. The possibility of getting a job in a factory is there, but not paying you a wage that you can actually live on, and that people know their prospects are so dim that they'd be willing to trade a limited lifespan for that being as good a life as possible, and that the only way that you can do that, you can finance that, is to be involved in drug gangs.
That's correct. You know, and you can find that in American cities if you want to go talk to these kids in some of the rougher parts of town. You know, they're not fools. They weigh the options. This looks like a good option. You're somebody for a while. You have money. You have girls. You get a car. You actually live the life you've seen on television. And then, of course, you die, because there are very few old people in the drug business. It devours itself. Start with, it's extremely competitive. You make a mistake in the drug industry, and you're killed. You lose a load, you die, etc. And so you're not going to have a long run. The guy I wrote about in the book is a freak, and he's not going to make it. He's a fugitive. He's got a contract on his head now of at least $250,000 from the Juarez cartel, and they will eventually find him and kill him, and he knows it. That's one reason he spoke with me, that you get a series of bad options, and you pick that option. He had a long run. He's probably killed hundreds of people. Frankly, he can't remember. There's been so many. But he's had, in my opinion, a terrible life. There's one other recurring figure in the book who warms my heart, Pastor Jose Antonio Galban. Hmm. He is a man who was a drug addict in Juarez, was raised there, is now recovered, had a religious conversion. He's a street preacher. And he goes around the city scooping up helpless, brain-damaged addicts off the street, taking them out to an asylum he built outside of Juarez with his own hands, and trying to tend to them and feed them, and when he can, get them medication when he has the money. He's constantly having his life threatened. And what heartens me is that in this absolute hell, somebody is trying to sell love in a city of death, and he's the person. So I know other people like that in Juarez. But it's like any human community. Everybody doesn't succumb to the terror and the evil. A lot of people try to do the right thing. What I want is for my government to help people to try to do the right thing by reexamining 3 policies. 1, Plan Morita, where we give money to the Mexican army, which is functionally killing Mexicans. 2, we take a look at our own war on drugs, because it's sort of obvious we're never going to stop people from using drugs. We failed for 40 years. And 3, we reexamine this free trade treaty, meaning if we're going to have a neighbor, and we're always going to have a neighbor, sharing a 2,000-mile border, we're better off if they're better off. And if they're not better off, they're going to come here. So if you want to, building walls isn't going to do it. Sending the army our army to the border isn't going to do it. I think we should step back, take a look at these policies, realize they're not working, and change them, or certainly have a discussion about it.
Yeah. You talked about this man, El Pastor, who tries to take in and help damaged people.
Well, they're real damaged. Glue sniffers. I mean, these people are never coming back. We're not talking neurosis. We're talking permanent brain damage from substance abuse.
You wonder, for people who who aren't at that point, though, how it is that anyone manages to come through this, to live in this place with their psyche intact.
Well, in El Pastor's case, I mean, he's deeply religious. You know, he was a criminal and an addict, and he's a devout Christian, and that's what sustains him. Even he has his fears. He's the man in the book, or I have this conversation with, who tells me he prays every night that when they come for him, they just murder him and he's not tortured. That's his idea of salvation. Well, there's another person in the book, Esther Chavez, who died Christmas Day, who got up one day in Juarez and said the way things are going here is terrible, started a shelter for women with real doctors, real nurses, real everything, and is now treating 30,000 women a year in Juarez who have been battered and raped. I mean, she's made a significant difference, and she did it by raising the money on her own. She wasn't wealthy. She was just a ball of fire, another one of my heroes. Hmm. What I'm saying is you can always do things. The worst thing you can do, whether in Champaign, Illinois, or Juarez, or say it's hopeless, I'll just go have a drink. Human beings can change things, but the first thing they have to do to change things is look at some facts. And as I've probably said at boring repetition on this program, we're not looking at facts. We're looking at things at fantasies. We say war on drugs when we know the drugs are more available than ever. We say illegal immigration as if we have a right to be astounded that poor people want to survive. These people coming north are not a threat to our national security. They're not coming here to blow up your house. They're coming here to work for you, to remodel your house. Now, I'm perfectly willing. I understand if people don't want more people in this country. Personally, I was raised in a state that had a little over 1 million people, and it has 7 million. But you can't unring the bell. We have to deal with what is, and what is a breakdown of Mexico and poor people fleeing here.
We have about 4 or 5 minutes left in this part of Focus, talking with Charles Bowden, author of the new book, Murder City. We have another caller in Champaign, and that's line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Howdy.
You know, what's sad about some of what you're saying, you talked about the pastor that's helping out. For years, there's been mission trips I've led by college students, and we've built 15 houses down there for people living in cardboard boxes. But last year and this year, those trips are cut off. There's very little going in there now except for adults and Mexicans here in this country. But what a sad thing for us that we were working with children and with adults. It's going to stop.
Well, like I agree, and I appreciate your effort. I mean, in doing that, frankly, I applaud it. But I can't pretend it's safe for you to go there now compared to before. What I can do is say that you apparently know more than our Secretary of State or the President of Mexico, who act like this is a cartel war, just a little skirmish or something. What you're having is a breakdown and death of a major city, Juarez.
Yeah, the people, there are so many sweet people there, and we can treat them like, you know, patronizing them. You know, so many groups go down there and share the basics. One woman in a shack, she looked at me and she says, "Why do you guys always share the basics? When are you going to start teaching our people how to deal with this?" And I have an enormous love for these people, and I'd love to hear more on how we can do better to help them.
Well, look, I don't have a silver bullet. I give money to El Pastor, to be honest. I'm not a devout Christian. That's not why I do it.
Yeah.
I just think if I got a guy who's actually taking care of 100 people who are totally brain damaged and helpless, well, that's a start. So I do that. You know, and this is the reason he created this thing is there is no health care in that city. You know, these people were living on the street. They were lucky to find a dumpster or something in it. A lot of them were go-go dancers and things, were destroyed by the life, et cetera. But as I keep saying, that we're never going to get anything better until we just finally admit the facts. And one of the frauds, many, is that Juarez is a huge, prosperous city because of free trade. Well, it's not a huge prosperous city because of free trade. It's a city full of poor people who until recently were fully employed in factories. We're paying wages that we'd call slave wages.
Oh, yeah, $50 a week, and then they have a problem with these folks quitting a lot.
Yeah, they wonder why they quit, like they're not loyal.
Right. And the factories, I'm sure you've seen them, are beautiful. Lawnboy and Lexmark, I mean, they look prettier than factories in Elk Grove Village in Chicago. I mean, it's unbelievable how nice the factories are. And across the street, there's a pile of wood and plastic where people live.
That's right.
And, they're running power off the high-tension power lines. Anyway, you understand well, and you now know why our trip to Juarez was canceled, and we went all the way to Puerto Prenesco, which was an extra 1,200 miles of driving for these Illini, and I don't know that we can afford to do that again.
Yeah, but you get shrimp there. I know Rocky Floyd.
Yeah. Well, that was a long, long drive for a mission trip. We're going to have to go somewhere else. And, well, anyway, we're not going to give up, but...
Well, look, I can't advise you. The risks are real. What I'm glad about what you're doing besides helping people is most of the statements in our country by our government officials, in my opinion, are based on absolute ignorance. If they believe in free trade, go pull a shift in one of those factories and go spend a night in one of those huts, and then let's have a talk about how the system's working. Well, they never do that. I've interviewed them. I mean, I'm a reporter. I go to Washington, hang out with senators. You'd think they were on drugs the way they talk about this. There's no reality in the way we discuss it, and I want that to end. I want people to know what you know.
We are at the point we're going to have to stop because we've exhausted our time. To people who want to read more, the book is out there now, and it's well written, and I'd say it's a kind of a journalism we don't see all that much anymore. I appreciate Mr. Bowden, you giving us some of your time and talking.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Our guest, Charles Bowden, and if you'd like to read the book, it's Murder City. The subtitle is Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. It's published by Nation Books. Our guest has won a lot of awards for his work. He's authored many books. He's also contributing editor for GQ and Mother Jones and has also written for Harper's, New York Times Book Review, and Aperture. In just a couple of minutes, we'll have some news for you from National Public Radio, and then we'll have another hour of Focus. And in the second part of the show, we'll be talking about bullying. It's been in the news lately as authorities in Massachusetts announced that 9 teenagers there would be facing a range of criminal charges in connection with the bullying of a classmate that ultimately resulted in the suicide of this young girl, a 15-year-old girl. We'll be talking with someone who is one of the country's leading experts on bullying, Dorothy Espelage. She teaches educational psychology at the U of I. She'll be talking with us in the next part of Focus. Programs here on WILL are made possible by the Auditory Care Center. It's an independent hearing care center serving Champaign, Piatt, Ford, Vermilion, and other East Central Illinois counties. Auditory Care Center offers hearing evaluations as well as selection, fitting, and repair of hearing aids at 892-5959 in Rantoul. We are WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.